Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Looking for any dope gifts for the holiday season?
It's coming up.
It is.
It's coming right around the corner.
Oh, man. That's true. For those of you who forgot, it's that time of year.
We're getting to that point, and we have a new fun thing we're doing.
Featured artist.
What?
It's so exciting.
It's actually very exciting.
Our featured artist for the holiday season.
Faith Sponsler.
We are obsessed with
Love her.
She's amazing.
She's a friend, a muse.
An alchemist.
Alchemist?
Artist. I would call her something of a wizard.
A mage.
Yeah.
Wizard or a mage.
She has done a collaboration with us, which she created beautiful, color-changing Art History Babes prints. Limited edition. There's not a ton of them, so you're going to want to get one.
Get them while you can.
I want that.
They're great. They're really
beautiful.
Fun.
Yeah. She did
I
an
love
amazing
her
job.
Color-changing prints. They're the coolest. Like, you just put them in some tea or some coffee and watch it change before your eyes.
It's beautiful.
Magique.
The whole process is super fun. And you get to be involved in the art, which is always a cool thing.
You will be a patron of the arts.
Yeah.
And those wealthy Italian men in Vatican City in the Renaissance, you'll be like them.
Exactly. That's what buying one of these prints will make you.
Basically.
You're basically a
cardinal.
Head over to arthistorybabes.com. Click on our featured artist tag. You can read all about Faith and her work.
Yes.
And you can buy as many prints as long as supplies last.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Limited supply.
Act fast.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the Art History Babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Jen.
I'm Ginny. And we are the Art History Babes.
Woo! And in case you were wondering, we definitely just did the Wayne's World countdown.
Yeah, she was like, 3, 2, 1.
You don't count the 2 and the 1.
I know, you don't count them.
You don't count the 2 and the 1.
The suck cut. It definitely does suck.
This is hard.
I know.
God, I love that movie. That is like top 5 movies.
Too.
It's so good.
Me too.
He lost his virginity in my dad's old bed.
What? Ginny, you don't just fucking drop that out of nowhere. What does that mean? What happened? Please tell
us. So, like, I was fully aware Ginny's father is friends with me, but this isn't.
I wasn't aware.
Yeah.
They don't see each other super often anymore. They used to, like, run track and cross country and shit together at, like, community colleges in the 70s. But, we were talking about. And he was like, yeah, he loves this. I feel like maybe we should have put that out.
You came out of nowhere with the wild information. Wild.
My dad remains anonymous. He's my dad and nothing more.
That was a solid information drop
right
there.
I literally already forgot what this episode is supposed to be about. Because I'm already fucking trash. Preface. I'm so drunk already.
Okay, anyways.
We are here.
What's going on?
We're here with our good friend, Zach Clark.
Oh my god.
We're here with Zach.
What's happening?
And we're going to talk about Albrecht Dürer. In case you haven't listened to our previous episodes with our good friend, Zach.
Good friend, Zach.
Tell us a thing or two about yourself, Zach.
Hey, everybody. I am a printmaker. I am a straight white Christian male, as we discussed in-depthly in the last episode.
That is a title, my friend.
I know. I live in Oakland still.
Oakland, California.
I make letterpress pieces and very blurry photograph things that are all generally pretty sad.
Nice.
He makes sad art.
I do, which I'm not a sad guy. Well, I mean, I don't think I'm a sad guy.
Your eyes is pretty cool, dude.
Yeah. We're in my studio.
His clean studio.
Clean studio.
The dirty studio is out back. It's a shed.
It's just a shack. There's some dogs running around it.
So, Zach was very sweet of himself to let us...
He was sweet of himself.
He was sweet upon himself when he allowed our presence here tonight.
Oh my god.
Like 10 hours.
Zach was very sweet and has let us record the podcast at his house. And we're in his clean studio. And tonight we're going to talk about Albrecht Dürer.
Yeah, let's do it.
Who's Albrecht Dürer? A big shot in the German Northern Renaissance.
Northern Renaissance. Pantheon.
Northern Renaissance is so much different and so much more significant, in my opinion.
I kind of agree. I was going to say this.
Like the Italian Renaissance?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the Northern Renaissance was doing way more. I'm sorry.
I'm with you, girl.
Yes.
I'm with you on that.
It's
hot take.
It's real. It's real.
I disagree, but I'm sure you understand.
When Ginny and I don't disagree because that never happens. That never happens.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about this earlier. No hate on the Italian Renaissance, but I am.
No hate.
Far more intrigued by the Northern Renaissance.
Yeah.
I agree with all your points, because I also think the Northern Renaissance is fucking dope. But that's where we diverge.
Oh.
But that's fine. And that's not the point of this episode.
No, but I want to hear
you. We will have legitimate... I think we should have a legitimate... We'll go back and forth. We'll do an Italian Renaissance episode and a Northern Renaissance episode back-to-back. Point, counterpoint, yeah. I think that'd be good.
Yeah.
But Albrecht Dürer, he is kind of just the man of, like, the Northern Renaissance. One of them. I mean, him and, like, Jan van Eyck, like...
Yeah, man.
They're Jan van Eyck.
Jan and Albrecht.
Albrecht Dürer. German from Nuremberg.
Ooh.
Nuremberg.
He was so German.
Born May 21st, 1471. Died April 6th, 1528. So right there in that hot spot of the Renaissance.
So he wasn't that old. He wasn't that old when he died.
No, he was 50
something. He was still a young man.
Mm. He was.
Tower of power. Forever. I mean, at the time, that was okay.
That was a good amount.
That's a long life.
I mean, he was still incredibly prolific, so... He got done what he needed to get done in terms of his artistic career.
He left nothing behind. There was
literally
nothing on the
nothing.
Table.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
He was all in.
He left it all on the field.
100%. In fact, his tombstone reads, "Whatever was mortal of Albrecht Dürer lies covered by this tomb."
What? That's good.
That's what I like. Yeah, so he, if that doesn't kind of fill in the gaps, he did a lot of shit when he was... when he was existing on this plane.
Yeah. No, he totally did. I mean, and the thing that's interesting about him is that what he was able to accomplish at a relatively young age, too, because he started out being an apprentice for his dad, who was a goldsmith, and then a painter also. So he was doing both at the same time. And then he was really interested in woodcuts, and started getting into printmaking, and then he just fucking rolled from there, and he was just such a good self-promoter of his own work that he became, like, really internationally known at, like, a fairly young age and was able to tap in
to multiple different art markets well outside of Germany. And also of Germany, of course. Like, he was super popular in Germany, but he was able to kind of, like, travel around himself physically, but also just his work and kind of circulating it around Europe and really getting his name out there as an artist, which was very impressive at the time.
He was definitely a business babe.
Oh my God, yeah.
He was one of the first really... one of the first artists that really delved into this kind of connection between art and commerce and, like, understood the idea of, you know, making money off of art. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but he revolutionized, like, the idea of, like, reproductions and, like, being able to reproduce images and then also reach wider audiences and make money off of what he was producing. Kind of goes hand in hand. He's also one of the first examples of the really the well-known genius artist. Yeah. He kind of started, I mean, like, if you had to pinpoint it, at least a lot of historians do, he kind of started this cult of personality around the artist. He really formed this idea of, like, artist as genius, and he was one of the first to really put a lot of weight on his signature.
Yes.
And
yeah, and Jared had a very nice signature. Mm-hmm. It was the
I drew
A.
It.
Oh, you drew it! It's a nice big A and a little T inside of the A.
I mean, you can look at it as, like, his own trademark, and this is one of the very first examples.
It's a big deal.
Artist doing that. Do you disagree?
Within the Western world, it's very important to say, because what he was actually doing was really just replicating the stamps of Asian artists. Japanese and Chinese. Chinese use stamps, like stamp signatures as well.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so, well, I mean, and that gets into a...
No, but that's a good point.
Yeah, no,
that's
a very, very important.
Like, to kind of go back to the earlier... to the Corrida episode that some of you may have listened to, that, like, part of the, like, really nitty-gritty slash elitism of printmaking, also, there's an aspect that we don't often say, when we talk about printmaking, we don't make enough of an effort to make a point, myself included, to make a point to differentiate between Eastern and Western printmaking.
For sure.
Because
for sure.
Asia was doing so many things well before...
Yeah.
The Western world, but just their language was so complicated that it caused for complications that it didn't mass produce as well.
Right. Yeah. And especially, like, when you look at woodblock prints and how influential those later became, like, way later. Mm-hmm. But they were around much longer before a lot of Western artists were starting to make their own woodblock prints.
I also think it's important to point out that he wasn't one of the first artists necessarily to be able to make money off his work. He was able to make money off his work within the common people. And so he was able to make money off of, you know, similar to, like, how here now in politics we talk about small donors versus big donors.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, like, he wasn't just living off of the Catholic Church.
No.
Definitely. He was...
No, Deere was enormously popular.
He was, exactly. He was able to reach larger audiences that... The artist wasn't able to do.
The Caravaggio
was. He was one of those artists who got to enjoy prestige during his life.
Yeah, definitely.
There are not very many of those.
He had indoor plumbing.
Hey! Indoor plumbing.
If that's not luxury.
Right now, I think that's luxury. Yeah. Whenever my toilet flushes, I'm like, wow. Wow.
Going back to his signature, so it's an A. With a D in
between the legs.
In between the legs of the A, which gets really interesting because Albrecht Dürer, a lot of his work is heavily religious, and it can be also connected to the idea of Anno Domini, the year of our Lord, A.D.
Oh.
Albrecht Dürer, A.D., Anno Domini.
Year of Our Lord.
Which connects to, I think, maybe the first work maybe we can discuss a little bit, which is one of the biggest ones. It was that time he painted himself as Jesus.
You know, that's why in my notes, Jesus of Nuremberg.
That,
1500 self-portrait. as Jesus.
Jesus.
Jesus Christ, your Lord and Savior. So Albert Durer, one of his most famous paintings, it's a self-portrait in which he very much resembles your Western conceptions of what Jesus Christ looked at.
Jesus was black.
Yeah, Jesus didn't look like that, but we like to think that he looked like that.
He was black, too.
But just the way he paints himself, his hair, his beard, just the general characteristics of this self-portrait, it's very clear and intentional he's trying to make himself look like Jesus. What do we think? What do we think about this self-portrait?
Hold up. I'm trying to look it up. Is it this
one?
Well,
he has several
self-portraits.
This one.
Yeah.
Oh!
Yeah.
Okay, so first off, I just want to say that his hair is lovely.
It's quite magnificent.
He looks amazing.
So this painting, so I'm going to jump off
Do it.
So I have wanted to see this painting for, I would say of his paintings, I don't think there's a painting I wanted to see more than this painting.
Yeah.
And it is in one of the art museums in Munich. And I went to go see it, and it is in, I was able to see it a couple years ago, and it's in a room with 30 other paintings, and it's one of those rooms where, like, paintings are on top of paintings.
Yeah.
And there were people all throughout, like, really jiving in on, like, some Bruegels.
Oh, sure.
And there was not a single person sitting in front of this painting.
No,
and there was
shit.
A cobweb, like, on the corner of the frame. And
they were looking at Bruegel over Durer?
Well, Bruegel's is the man, but...
I mean, yeah.
No.
You can appreciate Bruegel, both of them.
No.
And Durer, respectfully. But I, like, my heart sank that I was like, I'm the only person in this museum that cares about the most important painting in this museum, in my humble opinion.
Wow. That really
it was very strange.
Me. Yeah, that really surprised me too, because that painting's been brought up in multiple art history classes I've taken. Like, it's
he was a good painter.
It's also not a big painting. It's like 18 by 24.
Yeah.
It's not large.
Yeah.
It's just, like, it can fall into a salon wall without even noticing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it might be one right of those now. Things that's, like, over his paintings are somewhat overlooked compared to his prints. I don't know. I mean, because he went to Italy a couple times and learned a lot from Venetian color. And he did, like, this one painting for a group of German merchants in Venice called, like, Feast of the Rose Garlands. I'm pretty sure I can check it and put the image up later. But it's, like, a really busy painting, and there's so much detail in it and really bright colors. And it was just his way of showing, like, look, I can paint like the Italians. Like, I can jive with this shit, too. And he, like, has his own image in the background. And it looks a lot like that one where, like, it's his, like, very long locks, and he's just kind of, like, staring placidly out at you. And it's just, I mean, it's really,
Feast of the Rosary.
Oh, lovely.
Mm-hmm. Venetian color. I mean, he knew what he was doing. Yeah. He was able to adapt to, like, a lot of
different
locations and styles. It's pretty impressive.
He was very multidimensional. He kind of jumped all over the place and did it well. Yeah, you're right. He was very much able to adapt, I think, when need be, which, you know, speaks to his ability as an artist. Going back to the self-portrait, though, of him as Jesus, there are a lot of different interpretations of it. Like, what do you guys think in terms of what it was saying about his relationship to his, you know, belief system? Was it an example of piety? Was it an example of self-aggrandization?
I don't get a sense of piety at all. I feel like he is totally showing off. He's like, look at my hair. Look at the curls of my hair.
Look at my pretty hair. There could
be elements of both, too. I mean, the attention also to, like, what he's wearing and, like, just portraiture at the time, too. Like, when you look at the kind of materials that people are wearing, that conveys a lot of messages. Like, okay, I'm wealthy or I'm of a certain status, whatever. But, it could be both, where he's saying, like, I am very well established and I think highly of myself, but I'm also a pious person. I don't really know, though. I don't know.
Yeah, this is a painting that has always been a little conflicting for me as well.
Yeah.
But I have really taken it as the idea of, like, if we, you know, as Christians, if, like, we are made in the image of Christ and in the image of God. We all, there's an argument, like, we all are the image of Jesus and we all are the image of God. Mm-hmm. And so there is, like, a very arguably quaint, but, like, straightforward approach to that.
Definitely.
If you want to argue and believe that point.
Yeah.
I'll admit I'm conflicted about it.
Yeah.
I think that's an argument a lot of people have made, that, like, in a lot of ways that's what piety is that it is seeing Jesus in yourself. So, to an extent, maybe there is something pious about mm-hmm. it. But yeah, I do kind of agree that my initial reaction is self-aggrandizing.
Yeah.
It's very...
Yeah. Especially because we know that he was so good at promoting himself.
Yeah.
Exactly. You had to be good at doing that to be as successful as he was.
Yeah.
God, I don't want to jump ahead.
No, go ahead. You jump.
So, well, because, like, I have... You know, Albrecht Dürer was very, very, he was very close friends with Martin Luther.
Right.
He was a very active part of the Reformation, which for non-religious historians out there is really when the division between Catholicism and Protestants happened. And it was really based on the idea that the Catholic Church had this authority and the Catholic Church was always your mediator between you and God, and with Protestants, and with specifically with Lutheran, that you were able to have a personal relationship with God. And so the proliferation of his prints was a very radical, wild thing at the time. The idea that you didn't, you know, 'cause before you had to go to the Catholic Church to see the icon. You had to go to the Vatican to see the Caravaggios.
Right.
To see images of God and of Jesus, you had to go to these sanctioned places. And so through Dürer's prints, he was giving you the opportunity to have a devotional, to have a prayer card, to have these things within your life, to have your own image of Jesus in your life, which was very, very radical. So that said, part of me is like, God, this is really cool, and it's very counterculture, and it's this very, like, radical thing while still being a Christian thing. But then there is a tiny part of me that sometimes thinks, like, was he just a really fucking clever Thomas Kincaid?
It's
caused...
Dude, I get that vibe.
Like,
I get
like,
what happened
you know,
to Thomas Kincaid? What happened to Thomas Kincaid?
We have to do an episode of
I think
on
that
Thomas
should,
Kincaid.
I grew up on Thomas Kincaid.
But it's just...
And he was an alcoholic who declared bankruptcy and then died.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
My mom spent so much money on a Thomas Kincaid that she bought at Costco.
It's bleak. Wow. Yeah. And none of those were actually painted by him. They were all paid by...
Oh my god.
They were all painted by
my mom spent
assistants.
Like $200.
Yeah.
The painter of light.
Yeah. So, like, and, like, this has been a new... Honestly, within the last, like, 6 months, I've had this, like, way...
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Was he the Joel Osteen of the Reformation?
Wow.
And, like, I don't believe that. His work was so... It was so constantly intertwined with faith that I think he believed what he was doing.
Even if
there may have been problems that were problematic, and I always in general have a problem with reaping financial reward based off of faith in church and co-opting religion for financial gain. But there is a tiny part of me. It's he might not have cared because we know Caravaggio didn't give a shit about. He
was
sleeping with young men, and we know that that Da Vinci and Michelangelo was a pretty diehard believer, but we know that a lot of these other people weren't.
They did plenty of things that weren't strictly adhering to religious doctrine at the time. But the fact of the matter is, during that time, religious art was the heaviest seller. Like, mm-hmm. if you were a professional artist during the Renaissance, regardless of where you were in Europe, you were going to do some religious commissions. There was no getting around that.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it can depend on, like, the levels of people's devotion, but all those guys did it. And, like, you know, you have, like, different artists who were painting things like Christ in the House of Levi is that was during the Counter-Reformation. And, oh, fuck, what is that artist's name? Hold on, I'm gonna have to look it up. It's gonna drive me crazy.
Yeah, but like, well, and that, I mean, that on its own, the Counter-Reformation was this complete mythop by the Catholic Church to dump a ton of money into art to try to counter what artists like Durer were doing. And
Veronese.
And but there is one part of me that, like, no matter how problematic all this was, there is something really exciting about, there is something very exciting historically to me about the fact that, like, art was what changed opinions. And art is what guided people. To, like, not derail us, like, far too much. What's interesting is there are a lot of, I mean, it started right after World War II, but it's especially, like, true right now that there are a handful of these religious, there are a handful of churches and other, like, especially Catholic organizations within Germany and other parts of Europe that are starting to fund art again. From a, like, we are a church and we're funding art, but you do whatever with it.
That's
and
cool.
That has caused this, like, really feeling in me that, like, we, I'm speaking for me, not for the entire podcast, that, like, the church needs to be supporting culture making again, even if it's not culture they agree with. Art history, arguably up until abstract expressionists in the post-war period, you can't separate from church-sponsored painting. Because the church always had its hands in the pot. And, like, I wish that that was still happening. It was a part of being part of the culture.
For sure. Yeah, and I feel like art wielded a lot more, like, political and social power and influence during this time period than perhaps we can, like, see more examples of now. It certainly does in many cases now, just in some different ways. Yeah, it's really interesting to think about Durer and, like, what his position was in all of this. But, I mean, he made a lot of religious works.
He did. A lot of his works, yeah, were incredibly religious. And the fact that he was taking advantage of print technology and making these things accessible and...
It's so punk rock.
He was like the punk rock 14th century.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, printmakers in general.
True. Very true.
Like, because of the Gutenberg Bible, Europe became literate. Like, that's so, that was the fucking fanzines of today.
I know.
Like, it sounds wild to say, but, like, those are the reasons I'm a printmaker.
Yeah, like, that's fair.
I love that comparison because, having access to a printing press and making things reproducible and it's the entire ethic behind it is very similar to the punk rock, let's make something that is both accessible and relatable to everybody kind of a thing, which I think you can even go as far to say as that ethic has stretched into this, you know, the era we're in now in terms of the stuff like the internet and blogs on the internet and the way we reproduce images on the internet and the way we share images. And so I think it's, ever since the 1400s and 1500s, there's been a continuous rebirth of this idea of let's make things accessible to people that they weren't previously accessible to. And Albert Durer was one of those people. I mean, I don't know what I feel about what his intentions were. Like, it's hard to say
speculation.
Speculation. I have no idea if he really gave a shit about making things more accessible, but he did make things accessible because he could reproduce things.
And I mean, his work became so popular and reproducible that people were copying it, and there were, like, he had a case against this Italian printmaker. Marc Antonio Raimondi. And he forged some of Durer's works but made a few small changes to them, and a Venetian court ruled that it was not an actual forgery and that he was just an admirer of Durr's work, and that Durr should be flattered.
I kind of love it. I kind of love that.
But then in response, like, Durr started writing these warnings, like, in... as part of his print editions. Like, picture, like, you're 13 and you're writing in your diary and you're like, warning, anyone who opens these pages will be cursed, blah, blah, blah. It's kind of like that, but he wrote one of them, and I have it down because it's so fucking great. Okay, this was written in the colophon of an edition of Durr's engraving series, Life of the Virgin, which is a really popular series that he did. Published, this edition was published in 1511. Hold, you crafty ones, strangers to work and pilferers of other men's brains. Think not rashly to lay your thievish hands upon my works. Beware, know you not that I have a grant from the most glorious emperor, Maximilian, that not one throughout the imperial dominion shall be allowed to print or sell fictitious imitations of these engravings? Listen, and bear in mind that if you do so, through spite or through covetousness, not only will your goods be confiscated, but your bodies also placed in mortal danger.
I love it. I love that so much.
Such was his value in himself and his work.
Oh my God. I love, yeah, just that attempt to like put a hex on anyone. That reminds me, so in prepping for this episode, I watched on YouTube, there's a BBC documentary on Albert Durr. It's really good. They go through a lot of different stages of his work in life, and so I would definitely recommend it. But at the very end, they reference, essentially, like, they show lots of images of really just contemporary artworks that are based off of Durr's works, that appropriate his images and have turned them into different things. You know, just contemporary artworks that are working off of Albert Durr in a very obvious and literal way. And the narrator says that they copied, plagiarized, and travestied his work. Those are his exact words. And I, like, stopped and I was like, hold on a minute, bro. Like, I understand that you're an Albert Durr fan, but, like, it's just artistic appropriation.
And, like dude's been dead for a real long time. Yeah,
like, chill. Chill the fuck out. Yes, contemporary artists, they get ideas from artists in the historical canon. Like, that's what happens. No one has taken his work and reproduced it and said, this is my work. They have intentionally appropriated his image for the purpose of saying something about that image. That's what artistic appropriation is. So I just thought that, like, wording was so funny. Like, travestied his work is, like, taking an artist from a historical canon and, like, taking their work, and she passed out. God, don't even talk. What
the? Is this a 10-second pause here?
Oh, maybe Jen's passed out. but anyways.
So I would be remiss if we talked about appropriation of Durr. And we did not talk about Michelle Wilson, who I don't think either of you know, but she's an artist here in Oakland. She's a professor down at Stanford. Beautiful, incredible bookmaker. And her and a collaborator, and I forget her collaborator's name right now, I'm sorry. They have been working on a embroidery of Albrecht Durer's rhinoceros for over 2 years now.
They
take it around to different galleries, and, like, it's events, like, where they have days where people can come in and embroider the rhinoceros.
Oh, cool.
Interesting.
And, like, they're something like a third done, and it's 2 years in the process.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the size of a wall. It's a full, I want to say maybe 15 feet by 8 feet. It's a very, very big piece. It's very, very cool. She's based here in the Bay Area, and her and her collaborator do events where you can come, anyone can come in and sew, all throughout the Bay, Northern California. No, and they just recently did one at the Salina Zoo in Kansas,
duh,
where they have an African rhino.
Sure.
And so they came and did a sewing at the zoo with the rhino.
Yeah.
Yeah. So super cool. Her name is Michelle Wilson. Look it up.
See, that's an amazing appropriation of his work. I would never in a million years refer to that as a travesty.
No.
You know?
It's so cool.
Like, get real,
yeah, right?
Dude.
I kind of was just like, you need to chill the fuck out. Like, what a ridiculous, I don't know. Like, Albert Durr is great, but, like, calm down. But, yeah, so there is obviously an interesting relationship just from, like, Durer himself and obviously his admirers with this idea of appropriating his work. And
it is I think this is a real pause here.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break. we'll be right back. Hey, Nat, did you know that the FDA doesn't require tampon companies to disclose a list of the ingredients in their tampons?
That's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, so major brands use synthetic ingredients and harsh chemical cleansing agents, whereas Lola is 100% cotton and BPA-free.
And for those of you who are a little more environmentally conscious and don't even want to use the applicator, they make applicator lists, they make various sizes, and panty liners for those who want them. And yeah, you can customize your subscription so you can get exactly what you need, you know, in the right sizes.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it gets delivered directly to your door, so you don't have to worry about, like,
lazy girl's dream.
Exactly. Don't have to worry about running off to the store, because they will be there every month at your door. Also, $5 off your first box.
Come on, guys. Can't beat that.
Pretty exciting. Head on over to trymylola.com/babes. That's B-A-B-E-S. And start your subscription today.
Go, guys. Do it.
We're back talking about Albert Durer.
Sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're talking about Albert Durer.
Albrecht.
Alberto.
Wait, have I explained to you guys how at the Prado, his name is labeled as Alberto Durero?
I didn't know this.
Like, it's engraved on the wall outside of the museum.
Really?
Directly underneath Alberto Durero is Pablo Pedro Rubens.
Oh. I don't feel great about that. That'd be like, if they had exhibits in the States, and it'd be like, Albert Dern. I don't know.
We're still talking about my band.
Albert Dern.
That said, outside of that atrocity, I think the Prado is the greatest art museum in the entire world.
Oh, I want to go so bad.
I have not been. I've only been to Barcelona.
It's the reason to go to Madrid.
I've been lucky to go to Barcelona.
Yeah, I have not been to Spain at all, and I really want to go. Yeah, the Prado has so many important works.
It is an art history book.
Yeah.
It's insane.
But yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing, is just this attempt, and it happens everywhere. It happens in the United States. Titian. Obviously, it happens in Spain, but an attempt to change people's names to, like, fit certain cultural lenses. I don't like it. Like, let's just call people by what their names are, no matter what language it is. Like, you can figure out their names. Like, we're all smart enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's just call people by their names. Like, I think that's fair, regardless of language. Even if it's a language you're not comfortable with, you can figure out a person's full name, I think. Is there anything gained by changing, like, Albert Durer's name to Alberto Durero?
I don't think so.
I know, right?
However, like, I know that, like, Titian's name is not remotely Titian.
No,
it is very Italian name. That's the only one that I know that we in America totally anglify.
And I don't know why, because a lot of other Italian artists, we call them by their Italian names.
Yeah.
I don't know. I couldn't tell you that. I'm inclined to blame it on the British, but that's probably not fair. But I think it was probably them.
I blame the British. That's fair. Yeah. They have not given us anything worthwhile besides Francis Bacon when it comes to art history. So, You know what? I believe it.
We love you, UK. Sorry.
The only Francis, only Francis Bacon.
Oh, man.
Oh, God.
So, Albrecht Dürer.
Albrecht Dürer. Just a few more little biographical stuff. He had a wife. He had a wife. Her name was Agnes.
I just feel like he was, like, a total player. Like, I really think that.
I mean, it's possible.
I don't know any historical backdrop.
This would all help us know if he's a Thomas Kincaid or who's, like, a devout person? Who is the antithesis of Thomas Kincaid? Was he a Thomas Kincaid or a JP2? I don't know.
Who is the antithesis of Thomas Kincaid?
I would argue, like...
That is a question, like, for the masses.
In my mind, Albrecht Dürer has been the antithesis to Thomas Kincaid, but but now I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
He's such a mystery.
Yes.
He is. His wife's name was Agnes. He was given 200 florins to marry her.
Cool.
Which at the time was a hell of a dowry.
Dope.
Yeah, right? So he made hell of money to marry Agnes.
Oh, so glad I didn't live back then.
It was a different time, folks.
Oh. I think someone would have to give... there would be a dowry to marry me. I'm not worth anything. That'd be really awesome if that was part of it now, where, like parents are just like, God, our son is a fucking idiot. Here's $10,000. Please marry him.
I bet you that...
What were your student loans? I'll pay you. Take this asshole.
I bet you anything that is a situation that
you're
has existed.
You're probably right. It does happen.
Yeah.
that is a tempting trait.
But so he married Agnes, and he made one of his first self-portraits, painted self-portraits, to give to her.
Oh,
Self-portrait with thistle.
It's a good one.
From 1493.
Do you know what thistle is supposed to symbolize in that case?
Yes, I do. Thistle is often considered an aphrodisiac.
Ooh, that's right. Which
that's
is
the
so
one you give your wife.
Counterintuitive to just encountering that plant.
Yeah, right. So it's often considered an aphrodisiac. It's also supposed to be a symbol of luck and love.
Sure.
So he made this deal.
Appropriate.
Yeah, he made this deal with Agnes's papa, and then he sent her, and she was like, "Okay, I guess I'm under this guy." But then he sent her this self portrait him
she
with
was
thistle.
Like, yes.
Yeah. And she was like, "Okay."
What's up with that neck?
Yeah.
Those quads are not quads. What if that thing the Rock has instead of neck? Of a neck?
Yeah.
Whatever thing the Rock has.
This is a real Channing Tatum looking motherfucker.
Yeah. Wonder Agnes was taken by him.
Whew. That hat is interesting.
It's a very interesting self-portrait.
Yeah.
We'll have it on our images for you.
I know. Hello.
I know what's up.
Hello there.
Did you see
take
my thistle?
But also, he's kind of bored. Just like, I got this thistle. What are you going to do with it? I don't
care.
Do
this,
I got this thistle, but what have you done for me lately?
Oh, dear. We can voice him in multiple film
I know, right?
I feel like we really have his essence down.
Cool. I think so, too.
Yes, my fist.
No? Do you want to do that again?
Do you want to try that again? No.
In a German accent this time?
So he married Agnes. Should we talk about maybe some of his engravings that we like, we're into, that we're feeling?
Oh, man. There's a lot.
I know.
So many feelings.
First, let's just talk about, like, one of the most talked about artworks of all time. It's been written about, like, crazy.
Yep.
Melancholia from 1514. There's just a lot going on there.
I mean...
It is
a busy, busy, busy scene.
It is very busy.
Well, but I think that is essential to the Northern Renaissance as a whole.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
German painters have been, German artists have always been very busy artists.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. So there's a lot going on here. Melancholia, obviously reference to melancholy, which is one of the four humors, like one of the four... things. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
I was thinking of the Kirsten Dunst movie that I'm afraid to watch.
It's so good. It's so good. It's dark as shit, but it's really good.
I have a really...
That's like Requiem for a Dream. Watched it once. Don't really need to watch it again, but I'm glad it's good.
I have a really irrational fear about the end of the world.
It might be a rough one.
People... say that it was going to be today. Didn't you send me a Snapchat about
that? There was a conspiracy theory going back to our earlier conversation.
We got an hour and 4 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm not joking about those things, actually.
A lot of people thought the end of the world was coming today because there was, like, the eclipse and all that shit, and then there's all these natural disasters and stuff, but we're fine, so...
It's gonna be okay.
Back
to dirt. Let's distract you.
But interestingly,
we are still talking about the end of the world. Yeah, and that's like
exactly. Dirr was really into the end of the world.
I would say, and this is part of what makes me this is part of the argument for why I think he was true in his faith. A lot of really zealous Christians are very excited about the end of the world.
Oh yeah. That's a thing. That's a thing. I think that one of the things I struggle the most with Christianity. Is this idea that you're more excited for what comes after this life and then you stop appreciating this life. I don't vibe with that necessarily. And yeah, that's a very real thing. There's a huge sect of Christians that are like stoked on the end of the world because of the rapture and shit. And I'm I don't know about that. But yeah, I think maybe falls into that camp a little bit. He was very into the end of the world. He did a lot of work focused on the end of the world, but I think it was partially an intellectual curiosity as well.
Yeah, I think so.
I think.
Oh, God, I keep thinking of so many pieces of artwork I want to talk about. Keep going.
But Melancholia, if you haven't seen the Kirsten Dunst movie, you should watch it. It's really good. So this work, it's been written about a lot. It's been talked about a lot. And I think it is so central to his work and just, like, the Western art historical canon.
Yeah.
Because in a lot of ways, it's representing this relationship of introspection and intellectualism with gloom and melancholy.
Right.
So in a lot of ways, like, Durer very much considered himself an intellectual, and he very much considered himself a melancholic. Yes. There's actually a sketch of him where he's pointing to his spleen, and the spleen was considered the source of melancholy at the time.
He's
saying, so he's just like pointing at it like, this is me. So there's a deep connection between the intellectual and melancholy, which is so fascinating and so funny to me because in a lot of ways I consider it, I don't know, I think of it as one of the sources of almost this cult idea of the artist as genius, as melancholic, depressive trope, you know?
Sure.
This idea that the artist must also be tragic and depressed.
Yes.
It's like the only way to be introspective is to be sad as fuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, and in some... To some degree, I get that. Like, I don't know. Like, to be introspective can be very sad sometimes.
For sure.
But there has been, for centuries, this trope of intellectual melancholy marriage, you know? And I think this work is just that incarnate. Like,
I agree.
It's just, like, that's what's happening. It's... The main figure in it is very sad looking. My favorite is, I'm going to pull it up.
I have it up.
My favorite part of the whole thing is this little poodle at work.
I know.
He's just like doing some work. There's a little poodle. He's like solving math problems or something. I have never seen.
So chubby and serious.
Such a I've never seen such
entirely different from the Pootie of the Italian.
Exactly. I've never seen such a pensive little poodle. And he's just Chubbs McGee just like working. He's just working on something and I love it. He's maybe my favorite poodle of all time. It's so good. And then the main figure is just once again very, very pensive, looking off into the distance. Mm-hmm. Trying to solve the mysteries of the universe. But what's also very interesting about this work is it's just there's a lot in terms of math, and there are like hidden math equations in in the image. Like, what?
It's like a Sudoku board.
Yeah, there's a fucking Sudoku board, like, hidden in there. Like, there's a lot of interesting shapes. Like, so it's really this whole allegory of, what it means to be a melancholic intellectual almost.
Right. It's my cross to bear.
Exactly, which I think also explains why it's been written about so much. Yes. I think why a lot of intellectuals are drawn to this work is because... It's about,
for sure.
It's what it's about. It's about being an intellectual.
So,
like,
so okay, I have a question for you guys.
Yes.
As the artist to art historian, like, are you guys sad?
No.
Like, the same way that, like, artists are sad?
I mean, personally, sure, yeah. I mean, I don't know, I'm pretty open about the fact that I'm kind of, like, naturally a depressive, like, I think I fall into that camp, but work a heavy balance. But yeah, like the being introspective, I think can lead you to sad places.
Well, I think maybe a better way to phrase that is like, are you comfortable with sadness the way that most artists tend to be? Sometimes to an unhealthy level.
Yeah.
But I think that you, like, as we talked about on the last episode I was on, like, a lot of the work that I make is, like, inherently kind of sad. But I'm not necessarily a sad guy.
Yeah.
But I'm okay going through those sad places in a way that, like, I discuss with my wife that, like, she sees babies die on a regular basis. But and she's like, people die, whatever. And she doesn't get to sadness. Like, she doesn't like sad television. She doesn't like sad movies. She doesn't like sad books.
Yeah.
And... But I think that artists are okay with dwelling in sadness, and I think that there's a little bit of, like, you know, that's an emotion a lot of people don't want to deal with, and it's almost our responsibility to like, go into those worlds to tell stories about it.
Yeah.
Would you say that, like, you feel the same, or when you are approaching sad work, are you approaching it from a... purely academic point of view?
Me personally, not at all. I'm just like a very emotional being. I've always, my attachment to art has always come from a very real emotional place. And I'm also someone that I like to explore my sadness. I don't consider myself a strictly sad person. In fact, I think I can be a very happy person, but I think I work in extremes. I can be a very happy person, I can be a very sad person, and over time, I personally have gotten comfortable with exploring my own sadnesses, and my attachment to art connects to that in a lot of ways. I like art that works in those places because I like to delve into those places in myself and try and learn what they're telling me and sometimes just sit with them. So I relate to that very similarly, and I think, you know, that's part, like, while I am an art historian, like, and I don't make a lot of visual work anymore, I think a lot of what I do does operate in the realm of art. Like, I dance, and I write, and I try to express myself in more artistic ways, and I do it as an expression of those same things. So I think I can relate to the quote-unquote artist in that way, personally. I don't know about you, Jenny.
I don't know either. I've been thinking about that since you asked that question.
Libras don't really like uncomfortable emotions sometimes. But...
Yeah. I mean, I can embrace certain emotions at certain times, but I am also one who likes to process through them as quickly as I can and move on to something else, especially if it's an unpleasant emotion, most particularly if it's an unpleasant emotion. I think that a lot of why I'm drawn to art is that there are certain emotions that are, like, expressed and channeled through art that maybe I am not as good at embracing on my own. And if I'm feeling something that's, like, kind of under some layers and I approach an artist or a particular work that addresses that, then that's like a way for me to kind of forge some connection and maybe process that on a deeper level. Not to say I'm, like, not an emotional person, because I'm not, like a fucking robot.
No, not at
all. But I don't think that I embrace certain aspects of sadness, because I usually try and be like, okay, like, what are the causes, and, like, what can I do about it, and kind of go into it with that approach, which can be good and bad. It really depends. But yeah.
The Art History Babes take on melancholy.
Yeah.
No, I think that's, I mean, yeah. I think
I'm very comfortable with being alone.
Yeah.
Solitude.
And yes, solitude, 100%. It's just
solitude and loneliness.
Yes. Solitude, I am cool with. Loneliness, not so much. But I definitely feel that there's a big difference between the two. And I feel like people who are more comfortable with kind of, like, being introspective and thinking about, like, their emotions and what they're doing in their day, like, you can just embrace solitude more, perhaps, from that angle, which I feel like a lot of us do have in common.
Because, yeah.
Like, especially when you have solitude, like, you produce more work, and, like, you can
definitely
a lot of times be
Dude,
more creative
I've been...
and have more ideas when you're in that state of mind.
I have been living the hermit life for, like, a month now, where I, like, barely do anything. I'm, like, always by myself, and I'm so fucking productive. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, I get so much shit done.
Yeah.
I was telling Melissa yesterday that, like, as I was reading this, I was like, you know, being a nun or a monk would be so productive.
Right?
Like, all you gotta do is, like, do your church duties, and then, like, you just do whatever you are interested in.
Right.
And you read your books and your hermitage.
Yeah.
And you write your books about solitude.
Yeah.
And, like, that's it.
Can you imagine, too, like, being a monk where, like, you're working on illuminated manuscripts and, like, you go and you do your monk stuff and you go to mass and you eat in, you know, in the dining, in the refectory hall, and then you just, like, paint these very small, beautiful, detailed
You're
things.
Just describing a residency. That's what artist residencies are.
Yeah, it's great.
And, like,
yeah.
You know? Routine,
which they're even residents.
Tasks,
like a friend of mine. There's a residency in Idaho that is on a nunnery, and you're silent for a month.
You know what?
Fuck,
that
yeah.
sounds.
Yeah, I forget
that's
what it was
nice.
Called.
Pretty
I wrote
cool.
her. I wrote her letter of recommendation, but I don't remember. I don't remember what it's called right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, if I find out, I will give them the information to put up
yeah,
out there for all of y'all.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I feel like all of us, to a certain degree, embrace. Melancholy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think a lot of my my most interesting thoughts, a lot of my introspection, like, they're a lot of times they're very much influenced by melancholy. Like, it just, like, takes you to places that, if you let them, I think can be really interesting and really valuable. But also, you don't want to get lost there, because being depressed can
mm-hmm.
not be great also.
For sure.
But yeah, so that's melancholia.
Damn.
Got a little off the rails there. Sorry guys.
No, but honestly, I feel good. Like that's the point of that work, though, is to, like,
yeah.
take you to those kind of places. Like, it's a very interesting work. Let's see. Are there any other specific Durer works you wanted to talk about, Zach?
I mean, I think the rhinoceros is important that we mentioned earlier. But, like, just because it was, like, Europe didn't know what a rhinoceros was, and they just
yeah.
had... And so it's this very, very funny image of this, like, heavily armored animal, and Europe hadn't seen one. And Durer made this print of this rhinoceros that, like, is kind of accurate. It then spread all throughout Europe, and it was the Europe archetype of what... A European archetype of what a rhinoceros was.
Yeah, I mean, it's accurate, but it's also fucking scary.
Yeah, no, and
it
like,
looks like a battle ram.
Yeah, it's not completely wrong.
No.
But it is wrong enough that you're like, wait,
it's
got
scales
and
like a spine coming out.
It's a really, really interesting piece. And it was my understanding was like one of his most widely distributed prints of his entire career.
Interesting.
Because there was just that level of like European intrigue.
Of course.
You know, I think that's a pretty important piece. I mean, his Adam and Eve piece is pretty cool at the Prado.
Yeah.
But like, no. I mean, there's, I mean, yes, but no, like.
My favorite, well, I do really like Melancholia Love, but my favorite is The Four Witches or The Four Naked Women.
Yeah.
1497. It's just really fucking dope. Even though the reasons he probably made it are, like, the exact opposite of why I love it. Right. But, like,
I know.
So, it's likely, you know, it's either representation. It could be a representation of the four seasons, the four elements, Aphrodite and the Graces, the three Graces.
Such muscular.
I know, right?
And legs.
Or it's considered...
Oh, God, such a good piece.
I know! It's also considered four witches or possibly four girls in a brothel. And it's four naked women just beautifully, like, dancing around in a circle. And I love it. And it's really magical. A lot of people read it as an allegorical warning against discord. But to me, I think it's just a celebration of badass
butts.
Naked ladies. Butts, yeah.
Of just 16th century butts.
I love it.
These were butts. At this time.
Yeah. No, once I have money again, I'm going to get a copy of that print for my house because I love it so much. And I also think we should do Photoshop our heads onto the Four Witches.
I don't want to see any Photoshop that isn't Ginny on the angel, on the cherub or whatever.
Which one?
There's one of like your face photoshopped onto like a like fat baby angel.
Oh, are
something.
You talking about Los Borrachos, the Velasquez one where I'm on chubby ass Bacchus's body, like Bacchus with his like whole like left.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah,
that's a good one.
I mean, but he's kind of a pouchy Bacchus. So I get
We've been meaning to do another one of those though, like a Photoshop of our faces on a famous artwork. I think that would be a good one. I think we should add that to the list.
Yeah. Since we were talking about the apocalypse earlier too, I mean the Four Horsemen.
Oh yeah, yeah. We could also put us on the Four Horsemen.
You know, this print is like I never get tired of looking at this one because there's just
So much going on.
And the facial expressions of everyone. And, like, these skinny, nasty legs at the bottom of this guy. And, like, it looks like a... Oh, is that the Pope getting eaten by, like, a hell beast? That looks like
maybe. Tiara. Yeah, it might be.
The Pope getting eaten? Oh, my goodness. He's not having a good time.
Yeah.
He is
but that print is, oh, it's so good.
Yeah, it's pretty dope. Oh, that is really good. I love his work. They're just, like,
they're perfect.
So, yeah, they're just so, like, he's got that, like, medieval feel to them, you know?
He defined the genre.
Yeah, yeah. They're just, like, magical. Like, they're so good. Oh, just a few other fun things. Did you guys have any other works you wanted to talk about before I...
Oh, I really... I mean, it's like... I don't know if it's an important work, but I really love St. Philip in his study.
Oh, God. I'm going to get this wrong. St. Jerome.
Yes. And it's like him, like, drawing at a desk with a lion in front of him. I think it's a beautiful piece. I don't have anything more to say about it besides the fact that I think it's beautiful.
Nice.
Let me check that I got that name right. I'm pretty sure I know which one you're talking about. Yeah. Solitude.
Oh, it's Hell of Solitude.
Solitude Embodied. Plus a lion.
Solitude plus lion. That should be the name. And I mean, isn't that the dream? Like,
yeah.
Solitude and then just like
working
a...
Working at your desk with some cool ass... Animals.
Yeah, with like a majestic creature as your partner.
And
like,
a faithful dog for good measure.
Exactly.
And a human skull on the windowsill.
Always. Always. Just a few other fun facts. So we talked about his burial a little bit. His tombstone, Whatever Was Mortal of Albert Durer, lies covered by this tomb. After his burial, a group of artists exhumed his body and made casts of his hands and face.
That's fucking odd. Yeah. Not surprising, but
Because he was, like, such a big fucking deal.
Yeah.
They don't exist anymore, unfortunately.
Can you imagine if you just happened upon, like, a cast?
A Durr face?
A Durr's face.
Durr's like, rotten face?
Dead face.
His dead.
Oh, do you see that cast on my bookshelf? That's from Durr's dead face.
That was Durr's dead ass face.
If it looks like a sunken face, it's because he's dead.
I dug him up. I made a cast of his dead ass
so
face.
Weird.
It is so weird.
Oh,
but what does still exist? While the casts don't exist, there is still in existence. You can gain access to it if you have the right connections. A lock of his hair.
I was gonna ask. There's got to be a relic of.
There
Durr.
Is a lock of his hair, which is like.
Who?
Relics, man. We just pick people and we're like, you're important enough that I'm gonna keep your hair.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And it's just...
I keep vials of everyone's hair.
<Yes, he knows.
laughs> That's a joke. That's
no
a total
things.
Joke.
Yeah, so there is still a lock of his hair in existence. Going back to that documentary I watched on the BBC, the dude who is totally just like...
Spam
fucking... Boy. Yeah, he is... Hard for Durr. Like, he is
Does
very.
Does he have, like, some of Durr's hairs, like, in a locker?
I actually have tattoos of Durr's hair.
Just of his hair? Like,
is yeah, that... no, it's a really, like, it's just a lot, it's a very thin line that curls with his eyes. It's, you know, it's nothing.
It's Durr's hair.
But literally, so in the documentary, he goes and, like, looks at the Durr hair, and
yeah.
He's just like, I've seen this hair before in his self-portraits, and he's just
oh
like...
Oh my god.
This guy's way too into Durr, but...
See,
this
is where art historians can get fucking weird. Yeah. Jesus.
He gets... I mean, you do you, bro. Like, whatever.
Sure.
Like, whatever. Like, no hate, but...
Durr is his god.
Yeah.
Know.
We
cool.
all... We all have our weird things. Like, it's fine. But still, he was, yeah. So, I mean, that exists. If that's something you're interested in,
wow.
I'm sure you could make that experience happen for yourself if you really
so
want.
So, his hair is, like, on view?
It's not necessarily on view. I can't remember exactly where it's at, but it is owned by, like, a museum. So, I'm sure if you wanted
yeah.
to get access to it for research purposes or whatever, you could. It
yeah.
would just take some work and time, but... Yeah, it's not, like, out in the open, but,
yeah.
But yeah, it exists, and from what I could tell on the documentary, it's in very good condition, which is weird.
I think Durr took very good
His hair looks healthier
oh, yeah, sure.
than mine.
And that's 500-year-old hair.
I know, right?
600-year-old
like,
hair.
It with, like, very strong German eggs from strong
It was
German
just
mantle.
Strong German hair.
Strong German hair.
Speaking
I will say the Germans have great hair.
It's true.
It's true.
This Polish hair is not.
Durr possibly ? Died from malaria. We don't know 100%.
Interesting.
But he got malaria and then
when
died
he was in Italy.
Died not yeah when he was in Italy and not and died not
malaria
too long after
is
that.
Bad air in Italian.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Bad air.
Mm-hmm.
Wait,
malaria.
From like asthma?
No, like bad air from having a lot of mosquitoes around.
From malaria.
Yeah.
Sure.
It makes sense though. Yeah, mal air. Yeah, malaria. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he got malaria when he was in Italy. I guess it's not been fully documented because it's not his official like cause of death, but
oh.
died of malaria ? Possibly.
Oh.
Also, before we wrap this baby up, it's just for funsies, just a fun little thing. How about we talk about Durr and German nationalism? Should we talk about that real quick?
We also talk about my band.
Oh, yeah. We can, we'll wrap up with that because that's a light thing. But first, let's talk about Nazis.
Oh, do we have to?
I think we do. I think it's important that we talk about it.
Do we also talk about Jen maybe dying out there?
That's okay.
If she's puking on my couch.
No, she's fine. So, Albrecht Durr, unfortunately, the work of Albrecht Durr became a symbol of German nationalism. And there is a common phrase that they adopted. Durr as Führer. Gross. It's fucking gross.
To be fair... I wouldn't mind if Durr was in charge.
It could be better. But he became, his work kind of became a symbol of Germanic purity. And also because the Nazis loved Nuremberg, they just fucking. Nuremberg became the unofficial capital of Germany.
It's not the unofficial. That's where all of Hitler's building projects were.
But it was. It's not officially the capital of Germany, though.
No. But it's where like the center of like Nazism.
Exactly. So they made it their capital, and Dürer images got appropriated by Nazis, which is super unfortunate. And people adopted his work as an example of, it was essentially used to project like Nazi symbols as an example of a fake past of Germany, like a fake idealized past of Germany.
Which is so fascinating and not in a positive way of the fact that the times of Charlemagne and the times of the Northern Renaissance were the Holy Roman Empire, which was neither Roman or like terribly holy, and was actually within Germany. And so like they are reaching back to a time that wasn't even, it was like Germanic in region, but it wasn't Germanic in like the heritage.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And parallels contemporary desires to reach back to a past that doesn't exist right now. once again, it's one of those things. Obviously, Albert Dürer had no control over it, but the Nazis took his images and they appropriated them the same way neo-Nazis take images today and appropriate them. I.e. Pepe. Ugh. Shout out to Pepe. He's not supposed to be a Nazi symbol. Did you see actually recently the creator of Pepe did a bunch of cartoons where like anti-neo-Nazi cartoons. Cool. Like, yeah.
And then he killed Pepe off.
Did he kill Pepe off? Dope.
Which then a bunch of neo-Nazis on the internet argued that since he killed Pepe off, it was no longer his property.
Oh,
because people don't fucking understand,
property rights.
Property rights. What's the word of my
copyright, trademark,
intellectual property?
Oh, okay,
intellectual property. Also, Nazis are trash people. So let's just
let's just
go with that.
That said, if any of you ever find yourself in Nuremberg, go to the Nazi Museum. It is one of the most impactful experiences I've had in my entire life. Wow. And it's in the Colosseum that Hitler built 90% of.
Whoa.
It is, and they didn't demolish it. It is there in it is part of the skyline in the city of Nuremberg.
Yeah.
And it is an entire museum dedicated to how the rise of Nazism happened. And it is, it is
very interesting.
I've never been
chilling and insane.
Yeah, I would definitely be into that. That would be really interesting.
Incredible is not a good word to use with it.
Yeah,
but
I know what you mean.
Yeah, I think everyone who has a chance should see it.
I think the last time we talked about the memorial, the Holocaust memorial we went to in Germany, I referred to it as fantastic, and I was like, okay, like, that's totally not the right word, but, like, I meant it in a sense that it's, like, super well done and really important, you know? Right.
To go back to, like, melancholiness, I have really struggled with, like, what are the right words to describe enjoyment? Not enjoyment. Like, what are the right... Of traumatic things. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know either.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair thing to be grappling with. That's not easy.
Yeah,
I mean, like, being able to feel the impact of that and to have, like...
And to carry it in a positive way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Empathy's not right either.
I know.
Whatever enjoyment, whatever the, like, line between enjoyment and empathy is, it's that word.
It's in there.
I'm sure, like, there's a, like, you know, German word for it or something.
Probably.
We just don't know it.
Probably.
Yeah.
You want to tell us about your band?
Yeah, so if anybody out there is listening, I was hoping it would come up a lot more organically. But, so for a very, very long time, anyone out there, I have wanted to start a band that kind of sounds like The National 4 or 5 years ago. But only plays, like, worship songs written by German hymn writers. And
this is an incredibly specific band.
Oh, it gets more specific. And so we play very minor chord, minimal music, German hymns. And everyone in the band is a printmaker, and we letterpress the lyric sheets for every show the day of. So you have to be both a printmaker and a musician and a Christian and, like, into, like, minor chord music. We're going to be called Durr, obviously. So if anybody out there is interested in joining my concept band, I'm looking for members.
Yeah.
Zach Clark is. Reach out to me. That's with an H.
You can also reach out to their History Babes. We'll connect.
Oh yeah,
you.
just email them. Yeah, Durr. Ooh,
Durr. I like it.
Yeah.
I would love for this to actually happen.
I'll be in your band. I mean, I know I'm not a printmaker, but I can figure it out. It'll be fine.
Well, and the nice thing about, like, being a band that sounds like The National, just one song you have to be like for 3 minutes, and that's all you did.
Yeah.
You do nothing. And one person kind of talk sings.
Mm-hmm. Very talk, like. They're going to talk
they
sing
talks,
German hymns.
Well, no, they'd be in English, but like.
I feel like they have to be in German. Like,
I can't sing in German.
I don't know. For this niche to work, they feel like they
because like there is also like a spiritual aspect to it all. Blah, blah. Like.
So it's also a worship band.
Man,
this is the most specific niche I have ever heard.
No. Yeah, this is the most, like, I'm full of niche jokes. Like, yeah. Esotericism is my language, and this is the most esoteric art joke I've ever had.
Well, if any of you hear that concept and you're like, yes.
Yes, I want to join Durr.
I am about that. You can email us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. We will connect you to our friend Zach. Should we do a quick listener mail?
Sure. I have one pulled up.
Yeah.
This comes from Tara. Hi, babes. Just wanted to say thank you for your work in creating such a fantastic podcast, not to mention doing this while successfully completing your master's degree thesis. I work in the field, specifically contemporary art, and it is so wonderful to listen to your in-depth discussions that are both entertainment and education recap, all in one perfect marinated package. Aw. I love the way that you described that. It's so great to be reintroduced to subjects I learned about during my respective BFA and MA degrees. It feeds my professional development and art-loving soul. Keep up the amazing work. All my best and love from the North, Tara. P.S. I was just revisiting the Purple Mountains Majesty episode where you mentioned doing further in-depth additions on colors. I'm particularly jazzed about a potential podcast for Black. Can I get a Malevich and a Kapoor out there?
Woo.
Not to mention that curvy LBD number Whister's mom is voguing. Well, the Black episode...
It exists.
It exists.
Yeah. We definitely talked about Malevich a lot in that episode.
Yes.
So I should have talked about Whistler, though. We didn't get to Whistler. But, yeah, we talked about Hella Malevich in that one. We talked about a lot of good stuff in that one. That was a fun episode.
Yeah.
That one's coming out really soon, but actually, by the time this episode comes out, it will already be out.
Yeah.
So
I will write to you personally when I'm done talking. Tell you we read this your email on this episode and tell you to look out for the Black episode.
Yeah. Okay? So if you're listening to this episode and you haven't listened to it yet, go check out our Black episode. It is out and it's good.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your email, Tara. We really appreciate it. And your insight and your suggestions. As we've mentioned before, when people email us and give us suggestions, we try and hurry those episodes up and make them happen. So we really appreciate that. If you have... Zach's got something to say. His eyes just lit up.
Oh, no, I thought of another problematic man.
Oh.
Who?
Joseph Albers.
Joseph Albers. We've talked about
him. He's a Nazi.
Is he a Nazi?
He was totally a Nazi.
Oh, fuck. Right? That's such a bummer. We talked about him on Color Theory.
Because he's amazing. Like, he's brilliant, but he's a Nazi.
God damn it.
And what's worse, being a pedophile or a Nazi? I really don't know.
They're
both truly
They're both the worst. They're both literally the worst. His wife was kind of legit, though, wasn't she?
Well...
Was she a Nazi, too?
Well, I mean, it's tough to know in the 30s.
That's true.
Like, how much was she a Nazi sympathizer versus, like, married to a Nazi?
Exactly. She did a lot of important color theory work. We should look into her. Yeah. Maybe she's okay.
Maybe she's okay.
But, God, that's a bummer, dude. Because I really like his work a lot, but I didn't know anything about him personally. I knew a little bit about his work and, like, also, like, pedagogically, like, what he did in class. And I was like, dope. Son of a bitch. Yeah. Why do all of you white-ass motherfuckers have to be, cool. like, shitty dudes? Like,
not
why?
All, just a lot.
Just a lot. No.
Just some.
Not all, just a lot. Just a lot. Like, bums me out. I think that's why, of all the white dude modernists out there, my favorite in my heart is Chagall. Because he was, like, a legit dude, too. Like, he was a good guy.
That's great.
I love Chagall.
The Catholic church that he did in Mainz is fucking incredible. It was the very first church that was rebuilt post-World War II. And they intentionally asked a Jewish artist to redo all the interiors as, like, a sign of, like, Jewish Catholic reconciliation. It's beautiful. It's
I love so Chagall. Yeah. Like, I love his work and his whole thing, like, his whole vibe. I just love him so much.
Yeah.
But yeah, once again, like, when you get all those white boy modernists, like, a lot of them are rough, and it sucks. Yeah. It's like, why you gotta be like that? But thank you for listening to our episode on Durer. We don't really know enough about his personality to know if he was a piece of shit or not.
We hope. I want him to be good.
Me too.
Like,
me too.
You know, for Team Christian, we have so few good guys. Most of them are actually, like false, terrible people. Yeah. I want him to be good.
I want him to be good, too.
I really hope that, like, you know, when I got my mansion in heaven...
Sure.
Like, it's next to Alberto, and he's like, dude.
And,
you know, that'd be pretty
good. He
dope.
Could join your band!
Oh, no, Alberto and I are going to have a shared studio.
Yeah.
It's gonna be like Pitbull and Flo Rida. They live right next to each other, and they've got a walkway between their two houses.
Do they really?
I hope they do. They might. I don't know. I can't imagine it isn't. And that's gonna be like me and an Albrecht.
Oh my goodness. I really like this. I don't tell many people this, but one thing I do, and I'm not like a particularly quote unquote religious person, but one thing I do when I'm like, I can't sleep and I like am trying to get myself to calm down and go sleep is I imagine like what heaven's like. And I imagine just like really like positive things like in the clouds. I'm going to add that.
This is so interesting.
Yeah, I do.
Well,
I just
because
like,
I'm such an anti-cloud heaven person.
Yeah, I get that. But I just imagine like all the lovely things that I could ever want to do with my life.
It's just pugs jumping over tacos.
Yeah. Yeah, just lovely stuff. And now I'm going to add that to the list.
It's just
of
me
like,
and Alberto making etchings of pugs forever.
Yeah, and that'll help.
Winged pugs
with
clothes on.
And that will help lull me to sleep.
Yeah, I hope so.
So winged cheers. Pugs. Cheers to that, sir.
Yeah, pugs and overalls. So they got room for the wings.
Yeah, that's fair. They need to have cutouts for that.
They need to be in clothes for some reason.
We were on somewhere really good 3 minutes ago, and I totally took us off track.
I mean,
it was good.
I think the best way to end this episode is on pugs in overalls.
Pugs in overalls and angels.
Yeah, definitely. You need to envision that.
That's it. That's my next move after these politics pieces.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm just going to make blurry photos of pugs in overalls.
Fuck yeah.
With angel.
Please do.
Wait, punto?
Pootie.
Pootie?
Pootie is plural.
So, could we go like poogie?
Why not?
A little chubby poogie.
Many poogie flying in the sky. One Pugo is the leader of them all.
I love the little poogie. Oh my god.
Princi Peso Pugo.
Okay, we're done. Oh my god. We're done. Thank you for listening. It's been a good night. We'll catch you next time.
Oh my god.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Right now, I wish I could transport back to grad school and be in the studio and put this song on, because we would dance so hard.
Oh, yeah, me too. I want to dance.
Maybe it has to be the outro.
Yeah. No, that's my number one, like, way to try and stave off a hangover. Is dancing? Dance it out.
Yeah.
Gotta dance out the alcohol.
We are not being active enough to fight off the alcohol.
Exactly.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.